Welcome to Series 3 of The Great Humbling. What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to be less proud, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, ground, to be grounded, and humilis, brought to the ground, made low or lowly. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a poet, futurist, and recovering sustainability consultant. In the early days of the pandemic, I started recording these conversations with the author Dugald Hine, where we wonder together about the strangeness of the times we're in, the altered states into which they push us, and now, in this third series, the new moves that might be called for, if these really are times of being brought back down to earth.
It's Tuesday afternoon. I'm sitting at the shop counter in the old shoe shop here in Ostervoller. I've got piles of books around me. I've got a cup of tea. I think we're ready. Ed, here we are. It's episode 4. What's been whispering in your ears over the past week?
Oh, we had some kind words from David Rizzo over in the States about the last episode, Be Like Water. He said, any discussion of water invariably leads me to a discussion of grief, as water being heavy tends to seep deep into tree roots, cisterns, and of course becomes associated with soul. Your exhortation to be like water seems to me to be an exhortation to grieve the losses we will face and have already faced. But he adds also, water is regenerative and we can find hope in it.
So also following up on last week's theme, I got a poem here that came to me from Deepa Patel. This is Lucille Clifton's poem, Blessing the Boats. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving forever. And may you, in your innocence, sail through this to that. So, Ed, that was last week's new move, Be Like Water. What have we got for episode 4?
Are you ready? This week's instruction is, do shrooms.
I feel like I need to issue an advisory notice at this point. This episode isn't really about us being evangelists for mind-altering substances. Even if it was, you'd be unwise to go out and start ingesting psychoactive fungi on the basis of two guys talking to each other on a podcast. We will be touching on some of the history of, I was going to say plant medicines, because that's a term that I hear used in certain circles. But then one of the first things to know about fungi is that they are neither plants nor animals. Ed, do you want to lead us into what got us thinking together about this subject?
So the idea for this week's instruction actually came from reading Merlin Sheldrake's book, Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds and Shape Our Futures. And if you haven't read it, it's a truly revelatory book. As you say, Dougal, they're neither plant nor animal, but they are found everywhere in the earth, in the air, and of course in our bodies and on our bodies. 90% of their species still remain undocumented. Almost all plants depend on mycorrhizal fungi in some way, shape or form, which is what many people describe as the wood wide web, this kind of complex interconnection between organisms in a mature forest. Fungi also enabled the first life on land. They can survive unprotected in space. They thrive in nuclear radiation. And weirdly, they are effectively brainless, but have been demonstrated to be able to solve problems and manipulate animal behavior. They give us everything from bread to alcohol, because man cannot live on bread alone, to life-saving medicines, from penicillin to Taxol, which is a cancer treatment, and obviously have huge potential, which we'll touch on in terms of treating some severe mental illnesses. They're also hungry. They will eat pretty much anything. They'll digest plastics, explosives, pesticides and crude oil. They don't have a very discerning palate and extraordinarily productive. The estimates are that fungi produce something like 50 megatons of spores into our air each year, which is the weight equivalent of about 500,000 blue whales, just to give you a bit of scale there. And also you carry more microbes in your body than your own cells. And there is vastly more microbial and fungal DNA in your body. So about 20,000 instructions on the human genome, but there's something like 2 to 20 million microbial and fungal ones. So if you like, that's an example of the augmented reality of what it means to be human. So, I mean, Sheldrake's book is pretty much a tour de force. Where he takes us is into the ambiguity, the sort of confusing, perception-altering, both literal and metaphorical aspects of fungi beyond the simple science into the creative imagination. And he invites us to loosen some of our certainties, to sit with discomfort and inconclusivity and enter into this world of entanglement. So there is so much we could be talking about, but I'm wondering, how far are we going to go to talk about our personal experiences here, Dougald?
Shall I set us rolling?
Go on then.
I once had a fly agaric birthday cake.
That needs explanation.
It was for my 5th birthday. So you know the fly agaric, the archetypal red and white toadstool, Amanita muscaria. And there's something just absolutely compelling about them as a visual presence. And by the time I was 5 years old, I was fascinated by fungi. I probably knew more about them then than I do now. We lived in Leeds at that point, and the walk to school went along this area called Woodhouse Ridge. And at the right times of year, the woods there were full of fungi. So when it was my birthday, my mum made a cake with, there was a green field and some little mushrooms that had Cadbury's flake stems, and a big one decorated red with white dots. So that was my fly agaric birthday cake. I'll stick a photo of it on the Facebook page because it was a work that is worthy of celebration nearly 40 years later. And I guess we could stay with my mum and fly agarics. And the connection between the two is the novelist Alan Garner. I grew up reading Alan's books, The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, Elidor, The Owl Service, Redshift, The Stone Book Quartet. And I grew up knowing that my mum knew Alan and his wife, Griselda. She nursed one of Alan's children when she was in charge of a children's ward in Manchester in the early 1970s. And I knew that Alan and Griselda had shown her great kindness as friends in the years that followed. And by the time I was reading his books, which was probably a few years after the fly agaric birthday cake, this was all a little faded into the background. Our families were in Christmas card contact, and I was vaguely aware that it was a long time since Alan had brought out a new book. And then when I was in my late teens, he came out with 2 books in the space of a couple of years that became very important to me. And the first was a novel called Strandloper, which is based on a true story of a young man called William Buckley, a bricklayer from Cheshire who was among the first generation of convicts transported to Australia, who set off to walk home and instead became part of an Aboriginal tribe with whom he lived for the next 30 years or so, becoming a healer and a holy man. And the question at the heart of the novel is, what was it that the culture of rural Cheshire had in common with the culture of Indigenous Australia, such that he could take on that role? So in that sense, it's an inquiry into the Indigenous culture of this corner of supposedly Christian England. The second book is a collection of talks and essays called The Voice That Thunders, in which Alan tells parts of his own story and the stories behind the novels, the incredible range and depth of research out of which they're made. I think the reason those books mattered so much to me was that I was thrown into the strangeness of Oxford, into a social environment full of these seemingly self-confident young people who'd arrived at university with a whole cohort of school friends and social connections, whereas I hardly knew anybody in the whole city. And alongside that, an intellectual environment in which we were being given tools to deconstruct and analyse anything, to take apart whatever sources of truth or meaning our lives so far might have yielded. And if I had one magic object that held up under those hostile conditions, it was this little collection of books by this man my mum had told me about. Books which, as literature, could stand up to the best of what we were studying, which embodied another use to which the intellect could be put, besides the mode of cleverness that tends to dominate a place like Oxford. And the author of these books had been on track to the chair of Greek at Oxford, but had turned away from that ambition because it had stopped making sense to him, and devoted his life instead to reconciliation of heart and head through these books that he was writing. And there are a handful of writers whose words I found I could steer by when I was trying to get out from under what my education had done to me, trying to find the shape of a life that would fit. And Garner was the first of those. And then, when I was almost 30, I saw that he was coming to speak in London. And I went along and I asked a question that caught his attention. And afterwards, I went to speak to Griselda, bringing greetings from my mum. And through that encounter, 2 weeks later, on my 30th birthday, came an email from Alan Garner inviting me to come and visit them in Cheshire. It's a delicate thing, meeting a writer whose words have mattered to you. There's an asymmetry to it that can come close to what it's like when you're a teenager and you've built up a crush on someone who hardly knows that you exist. So there was an edge of that, arriving at the Garner's house for the first time and being taken around and handling these objects that come straight from Alan's books. If you've read any of those novels, then maybe you've noticed that there are always these physical objects made by geology or by human hands that show up like a talisman or a fetish. So the owl service is a real dinner service with a pattern that could be owls or flowers. And there's a book carved from stone that's in the heart of the Stone Book Quartet. At the time of that first visit, Alan's most recent book was a novel called Thursbitch, named after a valley on the Cheshire-Derbyshire border. And over nearly half a century of research, he'd reconstructed a set of beliefs and practices that may well have existed around this valley in the mid-18th century. And among these practices, the people are consuming red and white toadstools. So we're standing in Alan's study, and he shows me an object, a cylindrical container with what are unmistakably fly agarics carved on the outside of it. It has a few dried caps inside. "I'm told they're in perfect condition," he says. "I've never tried them myself." And I look at him and I say, "Far enough out already?" And we both laugh.
Yeah, probably. I also loved Alan Garner. You know, when you started to talk about him, his writing was something that I also held on to very closely in my teens. But it's interesting, isn't it? Those connections you're making, because these mushrooms, these fungi, these things have been used in human cultures for a very, very long time. But the vocabulary we use for them just now is quite modern. It was actually pioneering psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond who asked Aldous Huxley back in 1956 to suggest a word to describe the therapeutic use of hallucinogens. And Huxley had proposed phanerothyme, which is from the Greek for manifest and spirit. And he wrote back to Osmond saying, "To make this mundane world sublime, take half a gram of phanerothyme." To which Osmond replied, "To fathom hell or soar angelic, just take a pinch of psychedelic." And it's thought that this is where Osmond sort of seized on the word psychedelic, which from the Greek means mind manifesting or soul revealing. Although there's another sort of school of thought which comes from the mythologists and the ethnobotanists who in the 1970s coined the term entheogens, which comes again from the Greek, but means to be made full of the divine.
It's interesting to think about why the words are so new, how the need for a new language comes about. And it's like we're dealing with a sort of return from exile of something that's been part of human culture basically forever, that doesn't have a place in the dominant religious or rationalist forms that shape the modern world, and that then needs to be explained or justified in new terms by experts who are attempting to bring this stuff in from the margins and give it a new legitimacy.
And that's where I'd like to bring in another book, which is Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, because that's exactly what he's trying to do with that book, is to bring these ideas back in from the margins and actually riding the wave of a renewed interest in psychedelics in particular. And it's a literally mind-expanding book from an amazing author. If you read his previous work on the intersection of nature and culture, which is primarily food-based and perhaps most famously with his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Pollan actually sort of personally managed to miss out on the 60s counterculture revolution, not least because he was only 12 in the 1967 Summer of Love. But he brings this amazing journalistic eye and writer's pen, exploring the history behind these different waves, if you like, of psychedelic experimentation. And as you alluded to, Dougald, you know, obviously this takes in the thousands of years of sacramental psilocybin use in Mexico and Central America by the Aztecs, who called it Tiwanaku. I can't pronounce this. This is going to be like Csikszentmihalyi all over again. Tiwanaku, which, you know, in Aztec means food of the gods, which was a practice which was then brutally suppressed by the Catholic Church after the Spanish conquistadors arrived, who must have thought, well, this is not the food of our God. And Pollan takes us through all the bells and whistles of the Timothy Leary, Merry Pranksters sort of electric Kool-Aid acid test era. Although it does reveal along the way that one of those key counterculture figures, Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, actually first encountered LSD via a covertly CIA-sponsored program called MKUltra at Stanford University. So it's a great story which shows that sometimes the truth is wilder than the conspiracies. The counterculture revolution might actually have been accidentally started by the CIA. But Pollan keeps us on a sort of sober note. He takes us through to the modern Renaissance, renewed interest in the therapeutic use of psilocybin in particular for everything from deep depression to addiction and OCD behaviours. And there's one wonderful bit where he's talking about some of the research being done at Johns Hopkins University, where they even curated a Spotify playlist for people undergoing experiences and experiments using psilocybin in their research. And Pollan said, you know, it's like music is a literal stream of human consciousness. Losing myself in this music was a kind of practice for losing myself, period. And what Pollan does is essentially take everything, not all at once, but he sort of does an LSD trip, he does DMT, he takes psilocybin. And one of the things that comes out for him is this sort of temporary escape from Bayesian inferences, which come from Thomas Bayes, the 18th century philosopher who developed the mathematics of probability. And he says these inferences are where our experiences cause our minds to jump to conclusions. You know, so we are inundated with so much sensory data that your brain has biases and shortcuts and jumps to assumptions based on your own experiential history. And Pollan asks, he's going, is it possible that our perceptions on psychedelics, like those of young children, are less influenced by expectation and therefore more faithful to reality than those of supposedly sane and sober adults? Which is a point which is then reinforced by the brilliant ecological philosopher and writer David Abram, who makes a similar point around the use of sleight of hand magic. And he tells stories about when he worked as a sleight of hand magician in Alice's restaurant. He would do these tricks in front of people and they would leave the restaurant and then they'd come back in and they'd say, I don't know what you did to us, David, but the world looks different out there. The sky is somehow bluer. You know, what's happened? And he said his explanation for this is because he had confounded their expectations by his sleight of hand coin juggling. It ends up sharpening people's senses. They see the world as it actually is, not how they expect it to be.
I once spent a morning walking around and sitting talking with David Abram in the gardens of my old college in Oxford, actually, a long time after I'd left. And I can vouch for that experience just from the conversation. I certainly felt my senses more attuned as I walked back down through the streets at the end of that morning. So I can well believe that he had that effect on the punters at Alice's restaurant.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to this point about language. It's sometimes very hard to describe this re-heightening. You know, it's a cliche, but people talk about the ineffability of describing psychedelic experiences. But I mean, Pollan has a good go. And words don't fail him, I don't think. He says on his particular psilocybin expedition, he said, "I turned into a sheaf of little papers, no bigger than post-its, and they were being scattered to the wind. But the eye, taking on this seeming catastrophe, had no desire to chase after the slips and pile my old self back together. No desires of any kind, in fact. Whoever I was now was fine with whatever happened. No more ego. And that was okay. In fact, the most natural thing in the world. And then I looked and saw myself out there again, but this time spread over the landscape like paint or butter, thinly coating a wide expanse of the world with the substance I recognised as me." And he goes on to ask himself, who is this I? And he's thinking he needs a whole new first-person pronoun, which is not dissimilar to Tyson Yucaporta's references to the collective kinship I in Aboriginal culture, where he talks about us too. But Pollan says, after letting go of the desires, fears and defences of a lifetime, it was actually profoundly liberating. And he asks, could it be there is another ground on which to plant our feet, in which we've relaxed the ego's trigger-happy command of reactions to people and events. We've been freed from its tyranny, its maddening reflexivity, and its pinched conception of one's own self-interest into an ability to exist amid doubts and mysteries without automatically instinctively reaching for certainty. And I think it's that transcendence of our subjectivity that enables us to widen its circle so far that it begins to take in everything, you know, ourselves, others, and the whole of nature.
I'm thinking about something that Vanessa Andreotti says about how modernity is faster than thought. Like, we can't think our way ahead of it. It's so deep down in the way that our thinking even happens, the way that our brains and our bodies and our being are taking place. And this sense that maybe we need ways of tricking ourselves, like David Abraham with the sleight of hand, or like the experiences that Pollan is describing, in order to get out from under that thing that's there before the thought. You know, I've written before about the move from knowledge to knowing, how the acquisition of knowledge feels powerful, while the experience of knowing involves becoming vulnerable. And one of the images of that is the fruit of the tree of knowledge in the book of Genesis. You know, taking something in and swallowing it, being changed by it, the being consequences of that experience. But what strikes me just now is that even without swallowing them, mushrooms have a way of unsettling what we think we know about the world, especially our idea about the discrete competing entities, individuals, species, that we think of the natural world as being made up of. And now I'm thinking of Anna Lernhaupt Singh's marvelous book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, where she follows mushrooms and mushroom pickers, tracing these entangled stories. So she's looking at the biology of fungi, how they make worlds for others, create the conditions of possibility for other life forms, and connect up the roots of plants and trees, so that it increasingly stops making sense to think of a forest as being made up of these individual biological entities in the way that classically evolutionary biology has looked at it. Like, following the paths of the mycelium, life turns out to be messier, more interdependent and reliant on mutuality than the dominant stories of evolutionary biology have tended to allow for. And part of what fascinates Singh about this multi-species storytelling, as she calls it, is the way that it echoes across the human and more than human boundaries, echoes across from biology into economics. So she's studying this particular mushroom, the Matsutake, that is highly prized in Japan, but that won't be farmed. It won't be organized and scaled up. People can't get it to behave under human-managed conditions. It only grows in the wild. And these days it's transported across the world from the northwest of the United States, where it's picked by these different groups of people who she meets and talks to. And it's sold in Japan, where it's then given as gifts as part of a ceremonial tradition. And it's not just that the Matsutake grows in wild places, it grows in ruined places. Forests that have been exploited and abandoned by North American industrial forestry that destroyed the ecosystems that once flourished there. And now you have these new patterns of life emerging among the wreckage. I love the subtitle of Singh's book, On the Possibility of Life in Capitalist Ruins. To me, that feels a lot like the project of this podcast, is searching for clues to what it looks like to be humbled.
So we've been threatening to talk about personal experiences. And I'm now feeling like I had a deprived childhood in the absence of a Flyer Garrick birthday cake for my fifth birthday. But I obviously studied marine biology back in Swansea in the early 90s, which meant I had plenty of access to Welsh sheep-grazed hillsides and perfected my distinctive mushroom walk, that squatted or stooped scanning for tiny fairy caps as you move across the hillside. It's quite a giveaway. And ironically, actually, one of the best places that we used to pick mushrooms was on the military firing ranges in the Brecon Beacons. And I used to pick with a friend from Sennybridge. And invariably, the huge warning signs on the range fringes declaring the risk of live unexploded ordnance were a little unnerving. You know, we were seeking to blow our tiny minds, not blow ourselves up into tiny pieces. And apparently, so he used to tell me, the red flags that signalled imminent possible bombardment were always flying and weren't to be taken too seriously. So there's nothing like watching huge tanks trundling up an adjacent ridge to sharpen the senses whilst you're out mushrooming. Which begs the question, are mushrooms dangerous? To which I reply, well, it depends on where you pick them. I've had a few mushroom experiences, I think it's fair to say. One in particular sticks in the mind, not dissimilar to Michael Pollan's, but this was an outdoor experience, which I would say is the sublime one, which was on a beach in Rackwick Bay on the Isle of Hoy in the Orkney Islands. We had found the mushrooms growing above the tideline in the dunes, just on the edge of where the soil met the sand. And we ended up dancing on the wet sand after the tide had gone out under a completely cloudless starlit sky, which meant that there was sort of a kind of firmament of twinkling light above and reflected in the wet sand below. And it was on a storm beach fringed with these huge, round, stripy stones as phosphorescent waters lapped at the shore. And you know, the overwhelming thought was just, oh my God. I mean, this would have been a beautiful experience in any context. But the psychedelic experience took it to a whole nother level. And then the ridiculous one, which was actually in a nightclub, foolishly, the famous Melkweg nightclub in Amsterdam, where I'd gone to see a DJ friend play. And I remember being in the smart shop in Amsterdam trying to buy mushrooms beforehand, being presented with these Mexican mushrooms, which I'd never encountered before. And there was one large one and two small ones. And my friend and I said to the guy, said, you know, well, how much do you have to eat? And the very Dutch response just came, well, it depends on how high you want to get. and so we made the mistake. We ate one small one each, didn't feel any effects, so then ate half the big one each. I have very little actual recollection of the whole night, but I remember speaking to my friends the next day saying, weren't those tiny beers in the club last night brilliant? And it's like, anyway, they were pints, and I was convinced I'd been sipping beer out of teacups with a very Alice in Wonderland, complete discombobulation of perception of scale. And it, as I say, I share those two as a sort of the sublime and the ridiculous, because as Bill Hicks said, he goes, I took mushrooms and I went to Astroworld and I had a really bad time. It's like, good, because you're a moron. And I have to say, in the Melkweg, I was a moron.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to say something about my own personal experience then, besides the entirely innocent birthday cake. It's funny, I remember meeting Vinay Gupta. He pops up pretty often in these conversations, doesn't he? I remember meeting him for the first time in early 2009 in this squatted free school in Mayfair. And he said something to me that afternoon. I don't quite remember what he said, but it was along the lines of, "You've done a lot of acid, haven't you?" And that may just be how Vinay makes conversation with people he's meeting for the first time. I remember him once describing himself as having spent a large part of the 90s as a human trip toy in some party crew in Chicago who liked having him around because no one had a bad trip when he was in the room. Frankly, I find hard to believe, but I don't know that much about psychedelic experiences. This is becoming clear. So I said to Vinay, to be honest, I never touched the stuff. And he frowned and he looked at me more closely and he said, "With those eyes? You must have been one of the desert fathers in a previous life." My recollection of talking about such things with Vinay is that the only psychedelics he trusted were the ones made by humans in labs. As far as he was concerned, when you're dealing with plants or mushrooms, they've got an agenda of their own and they do not have our interests at heart. Which is certainly one way of looking at things.
Exactly. Merlin Sheldrake says something similar, actually. He said that he and other radical mycologists like Paul Stamets have literally been infected by fungi, making them mouthpieces for all things marvellous and mycological.
There you go. So I did once take mushrooms, and it was in my mid-20s. And I had a friend who I'd met at Oxford and who was really my companion in the journey back from that university experience. I don't want to sound too hostile to Oxford, by the way. I'm incredibly grateful for what I got from my education. I mean, I remember being there at the time of the tuition fees protests and being on those protests. And one of the slogans was, "Education is a right, not a privilege." And I totally get politically why it was being stated like that, but I definitely felt very privileged. And at the same time, it's equally true that it took real work to find a path back from that world and what it can do to you. And this friend, we were never a couple, but it was one of those friendships that you have at certain times in your life that have a particular intensity to them that maybe fill parts of the space that being in a couple might fill at other times in your life. And over many long emails and late nights and long, long, long hungover mornings, we talked our way out of what we used to call the theory hole, that place of clever nihilism that we'd seen some of our friends end up in and that we'd certainly had a taste of at university. And at some point along that journey, one late September, we took the coach out to the Ridgeway and walked to a little wood and set out a small grove of objects, a blanket. We had a few caps and she was more experienced than me in such things and we consumed them and sure enough, the shape of time began to change. What do I remember? A sense of being on a magic carpet, needing to hold on because the sheer force of reality flying past was so intense. Needing a line of story to hold on to. And a thought that this is what early childhood was like. And then I have another memory of a great stillness. At some point in the evening, somebody passed the wood where we were and stopped to ask if we were okay. And it felt like a visitor from another reality. You know, it could have been a passing god or a passing farmer. 20 years later, that's about as much as I remember of that. Except for being on the coach back as reality returned to its normal shape. How unlike the experience of the mind-altering substance with which I'm most familiar, that being alcohol. You know, there was no cloudiness or discomfort associated with the aftermath, but actually a cleanness and a sense of something being reset or resettled. So I'm glad I did it at that moment in my life. And to be honest, I've rarely felt any desire or need to repeat that experience.
It's interesting, that sense of reset, because that's where a lot of the therapeutic applications of psilocybin in particular are thought to lie, this ability to reset established brain patterns and habits. And also the point you're making about the sort of the slightly ritualized gathering of objects in the woodland, because the other thing that Pollan touches on in the book is that there's so much importance to scene and setting in terms of creating the right context for that type of expeditioning. And a friend of mine actually participated in one of the Imperial College trials, took a dose of psilocybin and went into an MRI scanner whilst tripping in order to have her brain studied to see what was going on inside. And she said what was interesting was the cold and slightly clinical setup of going into the scanner was not exactly numinous. But once she got into it, it was okay, because then she was going off to a different place. But it was certainly not necessarily the transcendental piece that you might have envisaged if you'd been lying on a rug with a close friend in the woods at twilight. And I think there's that crucial role afterwards that happens when we sit down and we try and integrate what we've just experienced. And that sense-making, I think, is perhaps the most profound piece, because it's not just about this wild hedonistic escapism. There's actually wisdom and insight to be gathered, but it needs chewing over.
I guess your friend's experience with the MRI scanner brings us around to that question of why the words we have to talk about this experience are very recent inventions, when the experience itself seems to be very old and widespread. There's a fascinating essay by the philosopher Justin E.H. Smith about agrarian shamanism in early modern Europe. The essay is called Out of Their Heads. It's about how the plant medicines, and no doubt mushroom medicines, of the peasant cultures of Europe were recognisably part of a patchwork with what European explorers and colonists were finding amongst the indigenous cultures that they were encountering elsewhere. And yes, encountering is very much a euphemism here. But there's something in what Smith is talking about that fits very much with Alan Garner's carefully imagined reconstructions of life in rural Cheshire a century or so later. Smith is interested in how this relates to the construction of a materialist worldview and to the separation of mind and body that is being established in European philosophy in the 17th century. So here's one of the key passages from his essay. All the evidence suggests that the peasants understood perfectly well that their bodies, along with their heads, stayed at home in bed as their spirits went out to engage in night battles. But it was simply not part of their worldview to suppose, from the fact that their bodies stayed home, that therefore what their minds experienced must have been a mere hallucination or phantasm. For the realm of phantasm, what goes on in what the philosophers were coming to call the faculty of the imagination, had not yet been reduced for them to mere private subjectivity, to something that seems to them to be happening, even though it's not really happening. In this respect, what we might appropriately label peasant metaphysics continued to share, well into the modern period, in the same basic understanding of the imagination, of dreaming and of phantasm, as the great majority of human cultures throughout history. According to this understanding, dreams and phantasms are every bit as real as the rocks that Samuel Johnson would soon feel inclined to kick in order to refute Berkeleyan idealism. They're every bit as real, but also real in a different way. In a way, namely, that would render absurd the endeavour to prove their existence by kicking them or locating them under a microscope. So that's Smith talking about what was going on at the beginnings of modernity. Now, when plant medicines are brought back from the margins today, or by the various different figures who have attempted to do that in recent generations, they generally need to be given legitimacy within a new kind of frame, a materialist frame that takes it as given that what's real is the bit that can be located in the chemistry of the brain, the bit that can be picked up by the MRI scanner. And I would say that here we're partly dealing with a version of something that we find in lots of different ways across modern societies, a pattern that relates to something the economic historian Carl Polanyi called disembedding. So Polanyi says modern industrial society is created through the disembedding of what we now think of as the economy from the social and cultural fabric. And then everything else ends up having to be reshaped to justify and order itself according to the needs of this newfound economy. What we're talking about with the plant medicines are things that have always been held within certain kinds of frames. Rituals, structuring stories, contexts of meaning that don't make much sense to the logic of the market or the state, exchange value or use value. It's not exactly that there's no ritual when people use these things nowadays, although sometimes, like your Amsterdam experience, it's just being sold over the shop counter as a commodity, and that tends to be a recipe for things to go badly. But when there is a ritual, generally it's either the ritual of medicine, which lacks meaning because it's grounded in materialism and brain chemistry and a very kind of reductive attitude to what we think we are and what we think we're doing. Or else we have this kind of free-for-all DIY, make it up as you go along thing that is so characteristic of a culture of consumerism, the pursuit of personal psychedelic liberation, which mostly lacks the kinds of structure or rigor or responsibility, care and attentiveness that are part of a viable culture. Because a viable culture isn't a weekend indulgence. It's something on which we rely. In that sense, it has more in common with medicine than it does with counterculture. And it feels to me like this is the challenge. Whether or not we're talking about a situation with mind-altering substances thrown into the mix, actually, is to thread a narrow path between those two tendencies, between materialist systems that create rituals and structure but lack any capacity to engage with meaning, or consumerist approaches to meaning and significance that aren't going to catch you when you fall.
I'd like to bring a conclusion to my contribution with introducing another idea, which is from Jonathan Haidt, actually the American social psychologist who wrote The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Disagree Over Politics and Religion. And in a sense, the outcome of either that, you know, medicinal or ritual type of approach to these experiences is ultimately about the cultivation of the hive mind, you know, the ultra social cooperation of human beings when we're at our best. And in his research, Haidt found several factors that accentuated this sense of connection and collaboration. One was deep immersive experiences of nature. The second was group activities such as dancing and singing together. And the third was Durkheimian drugs. And we use the drugs term loosely here, but Durkheimian drugs are named after the modern founder of sociology, Emil Durkheim, who coined the term collective consciousness. And he said it's this combination of things. You know, it's perhaps little wonder that many of us who might have at some stage danced together in nature under the stars whilst partaking of certain free seasonal fungi might be a little bit more hive-minded. Now, that can be, as you know, most of our experiences were in our youth. But Carl Jung wrote, it's not actually young people who need that experience of the numinous. It's actually the middle-aged who need it more to help them negotiate the second half of their lives. And I think for me, there's something about the fundamental earthiness of mushrooms. You know, their hummus and umami flavour, their chewiness as a metaphor for the ruminations and reflections they can inspire, their critical role as decomposers in the planet's great cycles. I mean, their facilitation of life itself that you were talking about right at the beginning, Dougald. There's something alien about them, yet intimate. you know, universal yet personal, immensely powerful yet gossamer-like and fragile. And it's hard, as Merlin Sheldrake articulates in his book, not to fall in love with their majesty and mystery, particularly as our current science struggles to fully explain their omnipotence and repeatedly falls short in its reductive approach to their weaving of life's web and weft. So I think it's about changing that story of our understanding and coming back down to ground from the perspective of a mushroom, as Sheldrake implores us to do, could be where the humbling really lies. Or as the late great David Graeber put it, the ultimate hidden truth of the world is that it's something that we make and could just as easily make differently. And mushrooms already do that.
So what is the instruction here? I don't think it's do shrooms. I don't think it's don't do shrooms either. I think it might have something to do with this. Getting far out is the easy part. It's finding your way home that's the hard work. It took Alan Garner the first 20 years of his career as a writer to find a way to bring back the treasure that he'd found in the heady world of Manchester Grammar School and Oxford and put it into service of what mattered in the craft culture out of which his family came and the place in which they were grounded. It took me a long time to begin to craft shapes of meaning, ways of making sense of the world that went beyond the cleverness of Oxford. And there's a sense in which such a process is always a work in progress. But I guess this is a good moment, as we wrap up this week's conversation, to mention Homeward Bound, this course where I'll be teaching from the people whose thinking and example helped me find my bearings in my 20s, and then go on to create the organisations and projects for which I've been responsible in the years since. It's a 7-week journey, and we've got two groups this spring, starting on Monday the 10th, Tuesday the 11th of May. So if that sounds like something you'd like to be part of, then check out aschoolcalledhome.org. We'll be back, Ed, next week with new instruction and possibly new safety warnings as we go along as well. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you're new to the podcast, we'd invite you to check out the journey we've been on over the earlier episodes. In Series 1, we explored the sense-making stories taking shape through the first months of the pandemic. And Series 2 tracked the altered states of consciousness, being and feeling that we were seeing around us. This is an open-ended process, and we're keen to hear from you. So please do comment, ask questions, and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or on Twitter, where Ed is at @FruCool. We're grateful to all of you who've been giving ratings, reviews, and recommendations, and sharing this podcast along your networks. And if you want to get deeper into the territory we explore in these conversations, do check out aschoolcalledhome.org. where you can sign up for live online courses and events. These are extraordinary times, a moment of initiation at a cultural scale. So thank you for being with us on this emergent journey.